You're listening to Radio Mighty, Acres from Voice in Your Home. You're now presenting the show. This is the Problem of Messiah, Judaism, with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome again to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates your fulfillment, the full realization of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and her sacraments. First of all, I have to kind of apologize, because if you were listening to last week's show, which was about whether or not Christopher Columbus was actually of Jewish heritage, whether he was a converso or not, I closed the show saying, I promise that next week it'll be back to being a theological show. Well, I'm going to violate that promise because, with your permission, so to speak, because in the course of researching the evidence for the belief that Christopher Columbus was quite likely of Jewish extraction, I became very interested in this whole interplay between Spain and the New World and the Jewish population in Spain and the Spanish Inquisition and that kind of the flows of Jews and Judaism in Europe in the 13th, 14th, 15th century, and what that had to do with Spain and what that had to do with the founding of the United States and so forth. And in the course of doing so, I also found some apparently providential coincidences, so to speak, very providential events and coincidences and so forth, including the I think high probability that Columbus was actually a Jewish converso. Also the fact that the date of Columbus's departure for the New World almost exactly coincided with the date of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, and also a providence that we'll talk about on this show, that the date of the appearance of Our Lady of Guadalupe apparently coincided with the institution of the Inquisition in Portugal, which was the last brick to fall as far as the Jews having a homeland on the Iberian Peninsula. So anyway, that's what today's show is going to be about. It's going to be about the 13th, 14th, 15th, maybe 16th century Jewish population in the Iberian Peninsula, the phenomenon of the conversos, the phenomenon of the Muranos, what they had to do with the Spanish Inquisition and the Portuguese Inquisition, and what they had to do with the founding of the New World. So that's the plan for today. And in order to talk about that more intelligently than I would be able to talk about it myself, I've invited a friend on who is, frankly, much more of an expert in this history than I am, as well as being a Sephardic Jewess and therefore having the correct being of the correct branch of Judaism to be even have more background and more expertise in this. So with that, I'd like to invite you, so to speak, to join us, Marie. I assume you're there.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You're actually.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You sound actually very clear. So my my intention is to I guess in some sense I'll let you start. Let me just lay a little bit of a groundwork, which is my understanding is that the Iberian Peninsula, that has Spain and Portugal, was essentially the refuge, the homeland for Jews in exile from the fall of the Roman Empire, actually before the fall of the Roman Empire, but certainly from the 8th century to probably the 13th, 14th century, maybe 15th century. It was their refuge. It was their home away from home. They were, of course, exiled from the Holy Land, from Israel, from the Middle East. And my picture of their home away from home in Spain is roughly parallel to my picture of their home away from home in the 20th century in the United States. And in fact, even now, the Jewish population in the United States is maybe a little bit less than that of Israel, maybe a little bit more than that of Israel. But just like the United States is really the refuge and the home for Jews today, it was almost as though Spain was that kind of a home for the Jews in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century. Do you want to concur, contradict Marie? Is that a, basically a fair picture?
Yes, I agree with you, and I'll try to give a 2-minute whirlwind of tracing Jewish history. We know the Jews, their first exile was in Egypt, and that was on their way to the Promised Land. After they came into the Promised Land, the Jews were there from the year 1200 BC until 600 BC, when the Northern Kingdom were exiled by Assyria. Those would be the 10 lost tribes that we hear about, who were scattered all over the world. For the next 200 years, the Southern Kingdom still survived as an independent kingdom, and then it was taken by Babylonia, and the majority of the Jews went to Babylonia. Now, Ezra and Nehemiah come back to Israel to rebuild the temple, and a number of Babylonian Jews came back, but most of them stayed. So from Israel, the main diaspora center was Babylonia, and it continued at the destruction of the Second Temple as well. When Jews were dispersed throughout the world, but that great number in Babylonia became the center of Jewish scholarship and correspondence around the world. Spain, actually the Jews of Spain, traced their roots, a good part of them, or the first ones, going back to the time of King Solomon. They're mentioned in the prophet Obadiah. And we have Paul mentioning his letter to the Corinthians, how he was planning to go to Spain. And we know that wherever Paul made his trips, wherever Jewish communities were, because those were active communities where people were not completely unaware of what he would be teaching. And he did want to spread the gospel to the Jews as well, even though he's the apostle to the Gentile. Anyway, okay, so you have a community of Jews in Spain. Now, the center was Babylonia until about the year 1000. Now that's coming along to where you were tracing how Spanish Jewry was the place for Jews from the 11th century on. In around the year 1000, there was a ship that set forth from Babylonia with a few great scholars. And they were going to a wedding, and their trip, ship was taken hostage. And the pirates realized that these were important men to the Jewish community, and that Jews in different communities had wealth, and that they probably would pay a good ransom. So the majority of these rabbis, I'm not talking about a big number, 4, 5, 6, but they were ransomed in Spain, North Africa, but basically the Iberian Peninsula. After a few generations now, before this had happened, all of Europe, whatever Jews were there, were sending all their questions to the Gaonim, who were the great rabbis in Babylonia. After a few generations, these rabbis, who now were settled in, mainly in the Iberian Peninsula, now became the rabbinic center. And as that brought Jews from other places, because the whole Jewish culture and leadership would be centered there. Now, that's around the year 1000, but the Jews had been there before. They experienced persecutions with the Visigoths, and then that's the 600s. They had the persecution of the Visigothic king, Catholic auspices, and they had similar persecutions and forced conversions and all kinds of things. But by the 8th century, in the 700s, Islam conquest took over Spain, and the Jews were given a free reign of occupation and commerce and into the governance of the state. And that continued. And that continued until about the 12th century. Okay. Then there was all this time from the Islamic conquest until about the 12th century, the Jews were back and forth between the reign of either Christian kings or Muslim kings, and it wasn't homogeneous. There were many little kingdoms throughout Spain.
Okay, let me
so
pick it up.
Functioned.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off mid-sentence, but I wanted to pick it up around then. So,
So following the golden age of Spain, of Muslim Spain, where the Jews were active in every area and living in a very posh life, and they were a good three quarters of the population of the Jews in the world.
Yeah, and 20% of the population probably in Spain.
20%, yes, of the total
Spanish population. Yeah, well, that's a very very large minority. I mean, that's a very significant part of the population. Let me kind of pick it up from there, and I'll leave you. I mean, I invite you, especially, to disagree if I have something wrong. But so they basically were allowed to rise in society and rise in positions and professions and so forth under the Moors, under the Muslims, and even with the reconquest of Spain by the Christian rulers, everyone had, or certainly the rulers, had gotten used to the Jews in those kind of leadership positions, and they became very valuable in government and in finance and in commerce and so forth. So even when territories in Spain, little kingdoms in Spain, were reconquered by Christian rulers, even though by a papal edict, actually, there were to be a number of restrictions on Jews, the Christian leaders, by and large, ignored them because they, basically because they were in favor of the Jews maintaining their position, and also because the Jewish community would pay large amounts of money to the Christian ruler in order to be freed from some of these restrictions. Restrictions like where they could live, restrictions like actually whether they had to wear distinctive dress and so forth. So the there wasn't that all the Jews were rich, but there was a substantial slice of Spanish society which was composed of wealthy and pseudo-aristocratic Jews who were dressing like, Spanish aristocrats and intermarrying even with royal houses and so forth. And one of my theories is that assimilation is much more of a danger, so to speak, among wealthy, comfortable, accepted Jews than it is among persecuted poor Jews. So, in fact, many of these, rich Jews who were essentially kind of almost like passing for Christians were becoming less, taking their Judaism less seriously, which then emerges in the phenomenon of conversos. This is my supposition, is that in fact some of the lack of resistance to the conversion came from their assimilation, which came from their acceptance by the society and from their wealth. So anyway, by the 13th century, you did have concerted efforts to convert the Jews. There still wasn't serious persecution of the Jews in the sense that there was in other places in Europe. In other words, they could still live more or less normal lives, but there were these efforts to convert them, led largely by Dominicans and to some extent by Franciscans, which took the form, among other things, of forced sermons where the Jews were required to show up, I believe, on a Sunday afternoon and listen to sermons explaining, basically Catholic apologetics, explaining to them how, in fact, the Old Testament and the Talmud support the idea that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah and so forth. And also these forced disputes or disputations between rabbis and church leaders theologians. I guess they were usually religious theologians, in other words, Dominicans, who would, and the Jews would have to attend, and the Jewish rabbi or rabbis and the Catholic theologians would have a debate on whether, in fact, Jesus was a Jewish Messiah. And this brings us to an area of special expertise of Marie. So I want to turn it back to her. But before I let her talk about this very famous disputation in 1263 between a Jewish convert to Christianity, Pablo Cristani, and Rabbi Nachumun, I do want to alert our listeners that there is an excellent movie, which basically simply presents the debate with a lot of the true content of the debate. And it's on YouTube to be watched for free, legally, and it's called The Disputation. So if you have any interest in this, you might want to remember that, and at some point just look for the movie The Disputation on YouTube, and then you can actually see a good representation of this disputation, which, if I may, I know this is coming a little bit out of left field, but can you say something about that disputation, Marie?
Yeah, sure. And by the way, that film is pretty much accurate from using both the Jewish record and the church record. It's an excellent film. At any rate, okay, yeah, the disputation of 1263. As you mentioned, all these persecutions that had come about, including these debates, this was the only debate where the rabbi was given the opportunity to speak freely. That was his insistence and his place in the community. The church allowed him to have that.
Let me just give some background so that our listeners understand what that means. The problem with a lot of these disputations or debates was if the Jewish rabbi said something like Jesus wasn't the Messiah or it wasn't a virgin birth, he would be guilty of blasphemy and subject to very severe punishment or death. So they were put in this position of debating without being allowed to say anything, which seemed to cast doubt on Christianity, which made the debate a farce, and this was an exception to that.
Yeah, this was an exception to that, and it was they couldn't say Jesus wasn't the Messiah or disagree with the virgin birth. They weren't allowed. The only thing they were allowed to say was this in the Old Testament? Was this verse in the Old Testament? Was this passage in the Talmud a yes or no? They could not debate.
But this was an exception to that.
It was their presence there.
This one disputation
seemed as if it was a debate, but it was not a debate, and it was very demoralizing to the Jewish community because they see, you know, their rabbi couldn't do anything.
But this disputation we're talking about was the exception to that. It was a Rabbi Nachman was allowed to genuinely debate. And he more or less won the debate, right? I mean, he did a very good job.
Yes. He did win the debate, but so his reward for winning the debate was that he wasn't killed and he was put into exile. But he was granted a tidy sum by the king who admired his answers. Now, his answers were not defeating Christianity. What they were doing was showing that some of the proof text that his opponent was citing, whether it be in the Old Testament or in the Talmud, that there were different interpretations from a Jewish point of view and how they came about that way. And it seemed logical to the king. He was not saying this was not the Messiah or disputing any particular Christian doctrine, but showing where Jews have our understanding of the Messiah and his coming and what he'll accomplish, etc.
And let me interject something there because of a little theological content, so to speak, which is that people often ask me, I don't know if they ask you, Marie, but they ask me, why don't all Jews see that Jesus was the Messiah? And they're used to the Christian apologetics, which point to these verses in the Old Testament that clearly through Christian eyes, clearly point to Jesus and so forth, and all these proofs that Jesus must be the Messiah from these Christian apologetics. And I actually kind of disagree with that in the sense that, of course, through Christian eyes, they do point very directly to Jesus. But that's not the question. The question is that text in itself sufficient to prove that Jesus was the Messiah? And I think that there is an element of grace, that faith is a gift. And I don't think you can say that unambiguously, simply on the basis of the text of the New Testament, of the Old Testament, you have to conclude that Jesus was in fact the Messiah. So that was the context of this debate, not a disproof that Jesus was the Messiah, which of course couldn't be true because he was, but simply that the Old Testament texts themselves do not unambiguously prove that Jesus was the Messiah.
Yeah, that's what that particular debate was about later on, and the debates were let me stay with the 1263. That's not Monday's debate. We had gone through this history of the Jews in Spain. It was very glorious. Now, this debate resulted in forced sermons to be attended by Jews in the synagogue by the Dominicans and the Franciscans, and this was an ongoing thing. And even though Rabbi Nachman won the debate, the Christian protagonists and the administration of the friars really believed that the arguments they put forth were still good to evangelize with.
let me move off the debate because we have 300 more years to get through in about 35 minutes. So.
Oh, okay. But just quickly, if the Jews heard it enough, they'll come around.
Okay.
So what do you want to?
No, let me just kind of continue with this rapid run through the history. So there were these evangelistic efforts in the 13th century, which were accelerating. There was a historical event that worsened the Jews' position in Spain very badly, which was there was a there were two claimants to the throne, King Pedro and his brother Henry of Trastamara, and King Pedro was actually very friendly to the Jews, and his treasurer had the suspicious name of Samuel HaLevi, I mean, obviously Jewish. And the Jews sided with King Pedro in this civil war, but his brother Henry won. And so when Henry came to the throne, this is of Castile, he had a hostility to the Jews. And he started enforcing the papal restrictions, which in principle were supposed to be enforced, but previous kings had not. And at this point, there began a wave of conversions of wealthy Jews to maintain their status quo. In other words, to be able to maintain their professional positions and so forth, since the papal restrictions, including, by the way, the institution of a ghetto about where Jews could live and so forth, were restrictions that these wealthy Jews were not used to and that they wanted to get out of. And as I suggested as a hypothesis, the fact that they were wealthy and pseudo-aristocratic probably had already weakened their faith. And then in the following decades, by the middle by the second third of the 14th century, in other words, the late 1300s, these religious preachers, there was an increasing kind of theological anti-Semitism, and there was more preaching against the Jews, and there was a rather notorious figure, this Ferrand Martinez, who was an archdeacon, who began a very aggressive preaching campaign against the Jews, and it kind of exploded in 1391 on Ash Wednesday, in the beginning of a avalanche of pogroms, pogroms being the traditional Jewish word for when angry mobs surge through the Jewish neighborhood or the Jewish quarter or the Jewish town, just indiscriminately killing and burning down and raping and pillaging and so forth. And so the pogroms began in 1391 on Ash Wednesday. And within a few months, maybe within 6 months or 9 months, it has spread to 70 Jewish communities in Spain. And in some large ones, including Valencia and Barcelona, not a single Jew was left. And the Jewish quarters, the Jewish were literally burned to the ground. And during this wave, it's estimated that 50,000 Jews were killed and perhaps 200,000 converted. So it was a huge wave of Jewish conversion. Of course, this wasn't by and large genuine conversion. This was sham conversion. The Jewish communities, which were destroyed by these pogroms, included Catalonia, Palma, Castile, Seville, Cordova, Toledo, Burgos, and as I said, there were 70 of them. And so now we're talking about the tail end of the 1300s. You have over probably 200,000 Jews who became Christian, only a small population of whom were genuine conversions. Most were these sham conversions. And that's where you get this term converso, which obviously is Spanish for convert, but it's used to refer to Jews who became Catholic. And then you have a subset of conversos, another term that will figure very prominently, called Marrano. Literally is not a complimentary word. It means swine, which is a reference to the Jews who became sham Christians, who underwent conversion and became Christian but did not have any faith. And they very often, usually, maintained Jewish practices, including keeping kosher and not working on Sabbath, not lighting fires on Sabbath, and so forth. And so the rest of this history lesson that I'm racing through, where it basically concerns conversos, who are the term for all Jews who became Catholic, whether they were genuine conversions or not. Marranos, who were those Jews who became Catholic as a sham, as a way of surviving, but who maintained their Jewish faith. And you also have the term New Christian. New Christian is synonymous with converso. So anyway, conversion efforts continued, as the ones that started with these pogroms in 1391. You had some very powerful Catholic preachers, even saints, who were trying to generate true conversions, in other words, really convince Jews of the truth of Christianity, including St. Vincent Ferrer, a Dominican saint. And in a single month in Toledo, he got 4,000 converts, and supposedly he baptized 35,000 Jews in the year between 1411 and 1412. I'm not saying all of these were genuine conversions. Of course, many of them probably weren't, but his efforts were definitely for genuine conversions, and he was actually in some sense pro-Jewish. Let me read a short quote from St. Vincent Ferrer. So here is the quote that begins, "The people despised them because they were Jews, but they should not, for Jesus Christ was a Jew, and the Blessed Virgin was a Jewess before they were Christians. It is a great sin to vilify the Jews. This circumcised God is our God, and you will be damned as will one who dies a Jew, for one must teach them the doctrine in order that they will be in the service of God." So, without putting my wholehearted endorsement behind St. Vincent Ferrer, it's clear that it was a genuine missionary effort on his part and not an expression of anti-Semitism. But in any case, this mass conversion continued, and by the end of the 15th century, that is by the end of the 1400s, the Jewish community was far smaller, and there were many hundreds of thousands, or at least several hundreds of thousands of conversos, and many of whom, or perhaps most of whom, were Marranos, that were sham conversions. And the problem of the Marranos was a very serious problem, because from a Catholic perspective, it involved a tremendous amount of sacrilege, because they were participating in the Catholic sacraments, they were receiving communion, they sometimes actually became priests and bishops, and yet they did not have the faith. And so that really is very serious sacrilege. Of course, the Jews could not see it that way, or the Muranos and the Jews could not see it that way, because from their point of view, you know, baptism didn't make any difference, especially if you didn't believe in it. But by Catholic teaching, baptism absolutely works whether you believe in it or not, and whether it's forced or not. So obviously there was a tremendous conflict between those two points of view. Meanwhile, many of these Muranos, a Jewish term for them is also anusim, which just means forced conversions, went on to very high careers in government, law, medicine, and even in the church. The Murano community developed a great deal of wealth. Muranos even, perhaps I should say conversos in this case, new Christians in any case, married into the royal family. And there was a lot of resentment generated in the old Christian community, that is the pure blood, so to speak, Catholics, at seeing so much wealth and power being siphoned off, and positions of influence siphoned off from them to these new Christians, with the suspicion always in the background that maybe they're fake Christians. Some of the examples of the high positions held by these new Christians or conversos were the presider of the Supreme Court of the Kingdom of Aragon, secretary to the royal household, vice chancellor of the kingdom, controller general of the royal household. The archbishops of Toledo and Granada were new Christians or conversos, and the confessor to Queen Isabella was a converso. The cardinal of Torquemada, who actually was the uncle of who would become the Grand Inquisitor. So now I am going to kind of continue forward to the end of the world for Jews in Spain, which comes at the end of the 1400s. Okay, because at this point, the Moors had been, that is the Muslims who had taken over the Iberian Peninsula, had been reconquered, with the exception of Granada. I'm still in the 1480s here. The Spanish kingdoms had depleted all of their funds in this war. And then the kingdom of Castile and Aragon became united when Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand got married. I think most Catholics are familiar with Isabella and Ferdinand. They're great heroes from the Catholic sovereignty world. I don't know how to put that, but that merger of the church and secular authority. And unfortunately for the Jews, Isabella's confessor at this point was Thomas de Torquemada, who a few years later became the head of the Spanish Inquisition in Spain. As I said, at this point, Isabella and Ferdinand got married. This was a consolidation of power. Isabella's confessor strongly urged the establishment of the Inquisition in Spain to Queen Isabella in order to stop the sacrilege of these Muranos, of the fake conversos. And under his influence, the Spanish Inquisition was founded in 1480. The Inquisition was introduced to Spain in 1480, with Torquemada made the Inquisitor General in 1483. And the Inquisition got very active very quickly. In the first year alone in Seville, there were 700 death sentences. This is of Muranos, almost all. I mean, maybe not 100%, but certainly 90%. 700 were put to death. Some percentage of them burned at the stake. Others were garroted, strangled. And 5,000 others were punished in other ways by the Inquisition, imprisonment or torture or exile, and confiscation of their property. And the source of those numbers is not Jewish sources, but Spanish Catholic sources. This is obviously an area of some contention, so one has to be careful about sources. Torquemada was, of course, very pleased with these results, but he really wanted to get jurisdiction over non-convert Jews also, who he saw as a problem. But he failed to get jurisdiction over the non-convert Jews. In other words, the Spanish Inquisitions, the rules of the Spanish Inquisition came from the church, and the church, the papacy essentially, would not give the Spanish Inquisition authority over Jews who were not nominally Catholic converts correctly, because there's no theological basis for the Inquisition to have any authority over Jews. Go ahead.
I'd like to interject a bit here. Torquemada really pushed gung-ho for this Inquisition, and Ferdinand didn't want to. He wasn't too thrilled about it. He also prized his Jews, as his later be seen with the King of Portugal. But Torquemada convinced Ferdinand that indeed there was much Judaizing going on, and as the king gave him the rule to investigate this, but it wasn't solving the problem. Then Torquemada, you know, as you said, he wanted to go after the Jews who had not converted. He says, well, these conversos are butting up with the Jews. They're together. Then you can't really solve the problem unless you get rid of the Jews.
Right, because the Jews were also convincing the conversos to go back to Judaism, and they were a bad influence on the conversos, kind of drawing them back to Judaism. But really, let me kind of race through a little bit, at least to the exile, okay? Let me get to 1492 and Columbus sailing, because we're only about, you know, we're within a decade of there. Anyway, in 1490... basically, a couple of things happened that made it easier for Torquemada to get his way. He couldn't get his way of having the Inquisition have authority over the Jews, but he did the next best thing, which was he got Isabella and Ferdinand to expel all of the Jews from Spain. In January 2nd, 1492, the expulsion decree was issued, on the basis, as you said, Marie, that the Jews were seducing the new Christians back into Judaism.
But that's debatable, but that was the excuse that was given.
That's what I said, on the basis.
The and the Jews actually did get along.
Okay, okay.
Strange, but they did.
But that was the excuse or the rationale. And anyway, so they were, the expulsion decree was issued January 2nd, 1492, and the Jews had to all be gone by August 2nd, 1492. Now, Columbus set sail August 3rd, 1492. And although all of his ships were ready and provisioned and in harbor, ready to set sail on August 2nd, 1492, but that happened to be Tisha B'Av, a day of the anniversaries of the greatest tragedies in Jewish life, going back at least to the destruction of the first temple, although I think there are earlier events in the Old Testament that are associated with Tisha B'Av. And it's a day of a very kind of cursed day in the world of Jewry, a very not propitious day for setting out on a major adventure. So some people suppose that the reason Columbus waited a day was to avoid launching the voyage on Tisha B'Av. And perhaps significantly, the very first sentence of his log recording his voyage, very first sentence says, on the day after the Jews were expelled from Spain, I set out. So one of the indirect circumstantial evidences that people point to for thinking that Columbus might have been a converso is, why would, in the context of this incredible adventure, enterprise, why would the first thing he mentioned be tying it to the expulsion of the Jews? And as far as I'm concerned, as far as Maria is concerned, there's a beautiful divine, I don't know how to put it, a divine interplay here, because in fact Spain had been the refuge for the Jews for the preceding, you know, 800 years or 700 years, and it had just stopped being the refuge for the Jews, And as Marie said, you know, God closes the door but opens the window, and now the path is open to the new world, which became the next major refuge for the Jews, frankly, pretty much until the founding of the State of Israel, almost. Okay, Marie, I know I've been running roughshod over you, so let me give it back to you if you want to add something.
A couple of things. I'm not going to go through the whole history again, but I just wanted to make a point about the conversos. You did make the suggestion that the wealth may have brought a certain amount of assimilation. It wouldn't be so hard to convert under those circumstances. And that was true for a certain portion, but there were still very religious Jews, especially before 1391, and they were in high places also. And in fact, the matchmaker of Ferdinand and Isabella was Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, who was possibly the richest man in the world at the time. And he was very religious, a commentator on all of the Bible, and he was exiled with the exiles in 1492. But so you still had Jews who were close to their Judaism still living within Spain from 1391 to 1492 as well. This is just interesting. King of Aragon, after the 1391 persecution, he offered that those Jews in his area of Aragon could return to Judaism because, according to him, and this is debatable in Catholic thought, that a forced conversion doesn't count. So he gave them the opportunity to go back to being practicing Jews openly, and the majority didn't. That most of the new converts, these conversos, they decided to remain Catholic.
And when was this? What was the year of this?
This is 1391, right on the end of the persecution.
Okay, gotcha.
That was when the king of Aragon had all along tried to stop the attacks in his area, and you know, it was more than just in Aragon. But then he offered the Jews that they could within his territory return openly to Judaism, but most decided not to. And you know, they had a lot of reasons. The apostasy, some of them felt they were not fit anymore as Jews. This has gone down by some testimonies. Others thought if they go back to being Jewish, so they will be subject to further attacks. That was obvious. Others saw that baptism would also take away different restrictions, if not against one's life. There were taxes and other restrictions that were put on the Jews. And as time passed, they just settled more into the new religion and became, this is the more modern scholarship to show, they became just as pious as other Catholics.
Well,
their children were baptized at first.
First of all, I obviously concur. I mean, St. Teresa of Avila was a converso, and John of the Cross was probably, I don't mean personally a converso, but a new Christian, John of the Cross was. But the fact that many of them became real Catholics did not negate the fact that some percentage of them didn't. And so the problem of the sacrilege, in other words, one has to be sensitive to both things at once, that many of them were real Catholic, mm-hmm. and yet the church had a legitimate mm-hmm. concern about whatever percentage it was mm-hmm. who weren't.
Right, you had secret Jews, right, the Muranos, that were actually practicing Judaism secretly and openly professing Catholicism.
And you even
then
had,
you their, had
you there was a case that of a I think it was actually a confessor to the Queen at some point, or who left Spain for Amsterdam. And, I mean, he was a priest. He was obviously a high cleric. I don't know whether he was higher than a priest, but he was a royal confessor. And when he got to Amsterdam, he not only reverted to Judaism, but he boasted about how, you know, he had pulled the wool over their eyes and had done this totally fraudulently for those years. I mean, so it's a real problem.
Definitely were secret Jews, but there were the pious converts, yeah. And then there was, which is more problematic, and which had continued even till today, where these are the descendants of conversos that practice some Jewish rituals, but they don't know what it means.
Yeah.
They're not practicing Judaism,
yeah.
And the same was true of conversos post exile. They also said, but that was problematic. Mm. Hence, the Inquisition had to wipe that out as well. You had no right doing Jewish rituals, even if it was not to practice Judaism. It was not something that a Catholic does.
Yeah.
So,
although, I'm going to now race to the end because we only have a few minutes left in the show. The Inquisition's draconian persecution of Jews who practiced Jewish rituals, obviously fell afoul of the Inquisition if you, for instance, wouldn't eat pork, or if you changed your underwear on Friday evening or for Saturday and stuff. These were obviously, could easily simply be traditions which are handed down or customs having no religious significance, yet, since the Inquisition had their eye peeled for fake converts, for Muranos, this tainted people. I mean, in other words, this was basically a proof of guilt, even though it shouldn't have been a proof of guilt. It was a proof of guilt that the person was not genuinely a convert, even though they might have simply been doing that practice because it had kind of become an independent tradition. But I don't really want to go there too much because of time. I wanted to get to 1531 for a very obvious reason, because 1531 was the date of the of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Virgin of Guadalupe. So let me quickly get to why 1531 is a very important date in this Iberian Peninsula story, which is the following. When the Jews were exiled in 1492 from Spain, the easiest place for them to flee to was Portugal, where they were still tolerated. So many of the exiled Jews, perhaps most of the exiled Jews who fled Spain in 1492, went to Portugal, and there they were happily tolerated until the King of Portugal, King Manuel, wanted to marry Infanta Isabella, who was the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, who were the rulers of Spain in 1492. So he wanted to marry Infanta Isabella, and she did not like the idea that Jews were at liberty in Portugal. So she made it a condition for the marriage that he do the same in Portugal that her parents had done in Spain, that is, exile all the Jews. And she refused to marry him unless he agreed to do so. So, in fact, they got married in December 1496, and less than a week later, a decree was issued to banish all the Jews from Portugal, effective in 10 months. However, Manuel, just like Ferdinand, in fact, did not want to lose the Jews, because they of their wealth and industry and their contribution to society. So he came up with a solution that he would basically force them to convert. They would be sham conversions, sham baptisms, but he didn't mind at all. They could continue to practice Judaism as long as they pretended a little bit to be Catholic to satisfy his wife. He forcibly baptized all the Jewish children in a single day, forcibly baptized many of the adults, and so forth and so on. So now you had a whole new wave of Muranos in Portugal who, unlike the Muranos in Spain, the government turned a blind eye. Nobody, basically, the authorities didn't mind that they were fake converts because the king had wanted them to basically do these sham conversions so that they would not leave. So Manuel was happy about this arrangement, and that was all fine until his successor, Juan the Third, came to the throne in 1521, And he did not like this arrangement, and he tried to get an inquisition to Portugal to solve the problem of these Muranos in Portugal. And Pope Clement VII actually tried to resist as hard as he could. But 10 years later, he had to yield to succumb to the negotiations, yield to the pressure, and allow the Inquisition to come to Portugal. So now we have the Inquisition in Portugal in 1531.
1531.
And
that's Our Lady of Guadalupe.
And that's Our Lady of Guadalupe. And that was the final.
Inquisition in Portugal would follow the Jews to the New World, but Our Lady was making a refuge for
them in the New World.
A place where Catholicism could live.
And so just when. That's right. Go ahead. That's okay. I mean, I was taking a little bit of a different slant, but not very different. But you have you have this, just when the final brick fell and the Iberian Peninsula was absolutely no longer a viable home for the Jews in any sense, you had this door opening up in the New World and this huge wave of growth of the Catholic world, 5 million native conversions to the Catholic Church in the course of, I think, 5 or 6 years, following on the heels of the appearance of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So just like the coincidence or divine providence of 1492, you seem to have this echo of it in 1531, and in fact, Brazil being the part of the New World that belonged to Portugal, became a major refuge for these fleeing Jews. And of course, with that flood of Muranos, unfortunately, the Inquisition ended up following them to the New World. But we'll have to leave that for some other show. But this time I promise again, it won't be next week. So.
But just to tie in quickly, I think we still have a couple of minutes.
No, we only have a minute. We only have a minute.
1521, that Juan becomes king, right? And he's not going to tolerate any Judaizing. 1521 was when the Spaniards extended their colonization into Mexico.
Oh,
10 years before Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Okay, again, a door
exactly
opening.
Exactly at the time when this person comes, here, there's that the door in the window again.
Great.
And then, of course, 1431, the exact time Portugal sends its first expedition to establish a colony in Brazil, and that would be the refuge. But
excellent.
Yeah, there's no coincidences.
So anyway, I only have about 60 seconds now. I want to thank you, Marie, very much for coming on the show, keeping me out of trouble, adding so much also. And I want to thank our listeners for listening. And once again, I promise next week's show will not be history, but I certainly find this exciting. Marie obviously finds it exciting. This interplay of Jew and Gentile in the time between the first and second coming is a very beautiful and rich and deep place to explore in order to see the hand of divine providence in everything. And that is, of course, why we're doing it. So with that, I want to thank you for listening today and invite you to join us again next week, same time, same place, for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism. And thank you once again, Marie, and to our listeners. Bye for now. Bye for now. Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks. Bye.